Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, I was discussing how Japan became the first nation in Asia to found its own independent state bank. The bank issued new fiat money, which was used to pay the samurai nobles. The nobles were then encouraged to deposit their money in the state bank and put it to work creating new industries. Additional money was created by the government to aid the new industries. No expense was spared in the process of industrialization. Money was issued in amounts that far exceeded the annual tax receipts. The funds were, after all, just government credits, money that was internally generated based on the credit of the government rather than on debt to foreign lenders. This Japanese economic model that evolved in the 20th century has been called a state-guided market system. The state determines the priorities and commissions the work, then hires private enterprises to carry it out. The model overcame the defects of the communist system, which put ownership and control in the hands of the state. Chalmers Johnson, president of the Japanese Policy Research Institute, wrote in 1989 that the closest thing to the Japanese model in the United States is the military-industrial complex. The government determines the programs and hires private companies to implement them. The U.S. military-industrial complex is a form of state-sponsored capitalism that has produced one of the most lucrative and successful industries in the country. The Japanese model differs, however, in that it achieved this result without the pretext of war. The Japanese managed to transform their warrior class into the country's industrialists, successfully shifting their focus to the peaceful business of building the country and developing industry. The old feudal Japanese dynasties became the multinational Japanese corporations we know today, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Sumitomo, and so forth. So it turns out that the Japanese state-guided market system was so effective and efficient that by the end of the 1980s, Japan was regarded as the leading economic and banking power in the world. Its Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, played a heavy role in guiding national economic development. The model also proved highly successful in the tiger economies, South Korea, Malaysia, and other East Asian countries. East Asia was built up in the 1970s and 1980s by Japanese state development aid, along with largely private investment and MITI support. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Japan proposed its model for the former communist economies, and many began looking to Japan and South Korea as viable alternatives to the U.S. free market system. State-guided capitalism provided for the general welfare without destroying capitalist incentive. Engdahl writes, quote, "The tiger economies were a major embarrassment to the IMF free market model. Their very success in blending private enterprise with a strong state economic role was a threat to the IMF free market agenda. So long as the tigers appear to succeed with a model based on a strong state role, the former communist states and others could argue against taking the extreme IMF course. In East Asia during the 1980s, economic growth rates of 7 to 8% per year, rising social security, universal education, and a high worker productivity were all backed by state guidance and planning, albeit in a market economy, an Asian form of benevolent paternalism." End quote. High economic growth, rising social security, and universal education in a market economy, it was the sort of commonwealth America's founding fathers had endorsed. But the model represented a major threat to the international bankers' system of debt-based money and IMF loans. To defuse the threat, the Bank of Japan was pressured by Washington to take measures that would increase the yen's value against the dollar. The stated rationale was that this revaluation was necessary to reduce Japan's huge capital surplus, excess of exports over imports. The Japanese Ministry of Finance countered that the surplus, far from being a problem, was urgently required by a world needing hundreds of billions of dollars in railroad and other economic infrastructure after the Cold War. But the Washington contingent prevailed, and Japan went to a low of 2.5%. The result was a flood of cheap money that was turned into quick gains on the rising Tokyo stock market, producing an enormous stock market bubble. When the Japanese government cautiously tried to deflate the bubble by raising interest rates, the Wall Street bankers went on the attack, using their new derivative tools to sell the market short and bring it crashing down. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So Engdahl wrote in response to what the Japanese government tried to do, quote, "No sooner did Tokyo act to cool down the speculative fever than the major Wall Street investment banks, led by Morgan Stanley and Solomon Brothers, began using exotic new derivatives and financial instruments. Their intervention turned the orderly decline of the Tokyo market into a near-panic sell-off, as the Wall Street bankers made a killing on shorting Tokyo stocks in the process. Within months, Japanese stocks had lost nearly $5 trillion in paper value. End quote. Japan, the lead goose, had been seriously wounded. Washington officials proclaimed the end of the Japanese model and turned their attention to the flock of tiger economies flying in formation behind. Until then, the East Asian countries had remained largely debt-free, avoiding reliance on IMF loans or foreign capital, except for direct investment in manufacturing plants, usually as part of a long-term national goal. But that was before Washington began demanding that the tiger economies open their controlled financial markets to free capital flows, supposedly in interest of level playing fields. Like Japan, the East Asian countries went along with the program. The institutional speculators then went on the attack, armed with a secret credit line from a group of international banks, including Citigroup. They first targeted Thailand, gambling that it would be forced to devalue its currency and break from its peg to the dollar. Thailand capitulated, its currency was floated, and it was forced to turn to the IMF for help. The other geese then followed one by one. Chalmers Johnson wrote in the Los Angeles Times in June of 1999, quote, "The funds easily raped Thailand, Indonesia, and South Korea, then turned the shivering survivors over to the IMF, not to help victims, but to ensure that no Western bank was stuck with non-performing loans in the devastated countries," end quote. Mark Weisbrot testified before Congress. In this case, the IMF not only precipitated the financial crisis, it also prescribed policies that sent the regional economy into a tailspin. The IMF had prescribed the removal of capital controls, opening Asian markets to speculation by foreign investors, when what these countries really needed was a supply of foreign exchange reserves to defend themselves. At a meeting of regional finance ministers in 1997, the government of Japan proposed an Asian Monetary Fund, the AMF, that would provide the needed liquidity with fewer conditions than were imposed by the IMF. But the AMF, which would have directly competed with the IMF of the Western bankers, met with strenuous objection from the U.S. Treasury and failed to materialize. Meanwhile, the IMF failed to provide the necessary reserves while insisting on very high interest rates and fiscal austerity. The result was a liquidity crisis, a lack of available money, that became a major regional depression. Weisbrot testified, quote, "The human cost of this depression has been staggering. Years of economic and social progress are being negated as the unemployed vie for jobs in sweatshops that they would have previously rejected, and the rural poor subsist on leaves, bark, and insects. In Indonesia, the majority of families now have a monthly income less than the amount that they would need to buy a subsistence quantity of rice, and nearly 100 million people, half the population, are being pushed below the poverty line." End quote. In 1997, more than $100 billion of Asian hard currency reserves were transferred in a matter of months into private financial hands. In the wake of the currency devaluations, real earnings and employment plummeted virtually overnight. By the IMF to unpeg its currency from the dollar barely 3 months before the dramatic plunge of the rupiah, its international currency. In an article in Monetary Reform in the winter of 1998-99, Professor Mikhail Chosudovsky wrote, quote, "This manipulation of market forces by powerful actors constitutes a form of financial and economic warfare. No need to recolonize lost territory or send in invading armies. In the late 20th century, the outright conquest of nations, meaning the control over productive assets, labor, natural resources, and institutions can be carried out in an impersonal fashion from the corporate boardroom. Commands are dispatched from a computer terminal or a cell phone. Relevant data are instantly relayed to the major financial markets, often resulting in immediate disruptions in the functioning of national economies. Financial warfare also applies complex speculative instruments, including the gamut of derivative trade, forward foreign exchange transactions, currency options, hedge funds, index funds, etc. Speculative instruments have been used with the ultimate purpose of capturing financial wealth and acquiring control over productive assets. End quote. Professor Chasudovsky quoted American billionaire Steve Forbes, who asked rhetorically, quote, did the IMF help precipitate the crisis? This agency advocates openness and transparency for national economies, yet it rivals the CIA in cloaking its own operations. Did it, for instance, have secret conversations with Thailand, advocating the devaluation that instantly set off the catastrophic chain of events? Did IMF prescriptions exacerbate the illness? These countries' monies were knocked down to absurdly low levels. End quote. Chasudovsky warned that the Asian crisis marked the elimination of national economic sovereignty and the dismantling of the Bretton Woods institutions safeguarding the stability of national economies. Nations no longer have the ability to control the creation of their own money, which has been usurped by marauding foreign banks. Most of the Asian geese succumbed to these tactics, but Malaysia stood its ground. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad said the IMF was using the financial crisis to enable giant international corporations to take over third world economies. He contended, quote, they see our troubles as a means to get us to accept certain regimes, to open our markets to foreign companies to do business without any conditions. The IMF says it will give you money if you open up your economy, but doing so will cause all our banks, companies, and industries to belong to foreigners. They call for reform, but this may result in millions thrown out of work. I told the top official of IMF that if companies were to close, workers will be retrenched, but he said this didn't matter as bad companies must be closed. I told him the companies became bad because of external factors, so you can't bankrupt them as it was not their fault, but the IMF wants the companies to go bankrupt. End of quote. Mahathir insisted that his government had not failed. Rather, it had been victimized along with the rest of the region by the international system. He blamed the collapse of Asia's currencies on an orchestrated attack by giant international hedge funds. Because they profited from relatively small differences in asset values, the speculators were prepared to create sudden, massive, and uncontrollable outflows of capital that would wreck national economies by causing capital flight. He charged, this deliberate devaluation of the currency of a country by currency traders purely for profit is a serious denial of the rights of independent nations. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And back to Malaysia. Its leader Mahathir said he had appealed to the international agencies to regulate currency trading to no avail, so he had been forced to take matters into his own hands. He had imposed capital and exchange controls, a policy aimed at shifting the focus from catering to foreign capital to encouraging national development. He fixed the exchange rate of the ringgit, the Malaysian national currency, and ordered that it be traded only in Malaysia. These measures did not affect genuine investors, he said, who could bring in foreign funds, convert them into ringgit for local investment, and apply to the central bank to convert their ringgit back into foreign currency as needed. Western economists waited for the economic disaster they assumed would follow. But capital controls actually helped to stabilize the system. Before controls were imposed, Malaysia's economy had contracted by 7.5%. The year afterwards, growth projections went as high as 5%. Joseph Stiglitz, chief economist for the World Bank, acknowledged in 1999 that the bank had been humbled by Malaysia's performance. It was a tacit admission that the World Bank's position had been wrong. David stood up to Goliath, but the real threat to the international bankers was Malaysia's much more powerful neighbor to the north. The Chinese dragon was not only still standing, it was breathing fire. Now we move ahead to waking the sleeping giant, Lincoln's greenback system going to China. When we look at the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, The Deadly Poppy Field, the quote is, "The flowers had been too strong for the huge beast, and he had given up at last, falling only a short distance from the end of the poppy bed. We can do nothing for him," said the Tin Woodman sadly. "He is much too heavy to lift. We must leave him here to sleep." Napoleon had called China a sleeping giant. "Let him sleep," Napoleon said. "If he wakes, he will shake the world." China has now awakened and is indeed shaking the world. The dragon has become so strong economically that it has been called the greatest threat to national security the United States faces, accounting for the greatest imbalance of any country in the U.S. trade budget deficit. This balance of trade problem is not new. The British were already complaining of it in the early 19th century. Then they discovered that exporting opium from India to China could offset their negative trade balance and give them control of China's financial system at the same time. The Chinese emperor responded by banning the opium trade after China started losing huge amounts of money to England. England then declared war, initiating the Opium War of 1840. The Chinese people wound up with two sets of imperial rulers, the British as well as their own. The leader of the revolution that finally overthrew 2,000 years of Chinese imperial rule was Dr. Sun Yat-sen, now revered as the father of modern China by nationalists and communists alike. Like the leaders of the Japanese Meiji Revolution of the 1860s, he was a protege of a group of American nationalists of the Lincoln-Carey faction. Sun's fundamental principles, known as the Three Principles of the People, were based on the concept presented by Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address: government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Sun was educated in Hawaii, where he built up his revolutionary organization at the house of Frank Damon, the son of Reverend Samuel Damon, who had run the Hawaii delegation to the American Centennial in Philadelphia in 1876. Frank Damon provided money, support, and military training to Sun's organization, and Hawaii became its base for making a revolutionary movement in China. The Chinese Republic was proclaimed just before World War I. After Sun's death, the nationalists lost control of mainland China to the Chinese communists, who founded the People's Republic of China in 1949. But the communists retained much of the American system in creating their monetary scheme, which was a Chinese variation of Lincoln's greenback program. Before that, banknotes had been issued by a variety of private banks. After 1949, these banknotes were recalled and the renminbi, or the people's currency, became the sole legal currency. Issued by the People's Bank of China, a wholly government-owned bank, the United States and other Western countries imposed an embargo against China in the 1950s, blocking trade between it and most of the rest of the world except the Soviet bloc. China then adopted a Soviet-style, centrally planned economy, but after 1978, It pursued an open-door policy and was transformed into a market economy. Private industry is now flourishing in China, and privatization has been creeping into its banking system as well, but it still has government-owned banks that can issue national credit for domestic development. By 2004, China was leading the world in economic productivity, growing at 9% annually. In the first quarter of 2007, its economic growth was up to a remarkable 11.1%, with retail sales climbing 15.3%. The commonly held explanation for this impressive growth is that the Chinese are willing to work for what amounts to slave wages. But the starving poor of Africa, Indonesia, and Latin America are equally willing, yet their economies are languishing. Something else distinguishes China, and one key difference is its banking system. China has a government-issued currency and a system of national banks that are majority-owned by the nation. According to Wikipedia, the People's Bank of China is unusual in acting as a national bank, focused on the country, not on the currency. The notion of the national banking as opposed to private central banking goes back to Lincoln, Carey, and the American nationalists. Henry C.K. Liu distinguishes the two systems like this. A national bank serves the nation and its people. A central bank serves private international finance. He writes, quote, "A national bank does not seek independence from the government. The independence of central banks is a euphemism for a shift from institutional loyalty to national economic well-being toward institutional loyalty to the smooth functioning of a global financial architecture. Today, that means the sacrifice of local economies in a financial food chain that feeds the issuer of U.S. dollars. It is the monetary aspect of the predatory effects of globalization." Historically, the term central bank has been interchangeable with the term national bank. However, with the globalization of financial markets in recent decades, a central bank has become fundamentally different from a national bank. The mandate of a national bank is to finance the sustainable development of the national economy. The mandate of a modern-day central bank is to safeguard the value of a nation's currency in a globalized financial market through economic recession and negative growth if necessary. The best monetary policy in the context of central banking is set by universal rules of price stability, unaffected by the economic needs or political considerations of individual nations. End quote. In 1959, a central bank law was passed in China granting central bank status to the People's Bank of China, shifting the People's Bank away from its previous role as a national bank. But Liu says the shift was in name more than in form. Quote, "It is safe to say that the Public Bank of China still follows the policy directives of the Chinese government. Unlike the Fed, which has an arm's-length relationship with the U.S. Treasury, the Public Bank of China manages the state treasury as its fiscal agent. Recent Chinese policy has shifted back in populist directions to provide affirmative financial assistance to the poor and the undeveloped rural and interior regions, and to reverse blatant income disparity and economic regional imbalances. It can be anticipated that this policy shift will raise the questions in the capitalist West of the political independence of the Public Bank of China. Western neoliberals will be predictably critical of the Public Bank for directing money to where the country needs it most, rather than to the part of the economy where the bank profit would be highest." End quote. And we'll continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.